Welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, and boy is that true, first episode since May. Occasionally amusing and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is titled Stories We Never Tell, and it's about a collection of poems containing a poem called Stories We Never Tell, and that collection is called Something Here Will Grow. Our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about the collection of poems entitled Something Here Will Grow. The author of that collection, Jeanette Schaefer. Jeanette, hello, and thank you for being the first and forever guest on our lovely little podcast.
Well, it is lovely to be back. So not only was this the first podcast I'd ever listened to, it was the first podcast I'd ever been a guest of.
Wow. That is exciting. I feel honored to be the first podcast. What an inauspicious beginning to the world of podcasts.
I remember the first time you had asked me to be a guest on your podcast, I said, sure. And I honestly, at that point, didn't know what a podcast was. So as soon as I got off the phone with you, I had Googled what a podcast was. And I was like, oh, so it's like a radio show. I love that.
Yeah. It's like a radio show. And actually, it was the only reason why I did this, or I am doing this, or this exists, was I went to see a Kevin Smith spoken word performance. Mm. And it was 2 hours of him saying, no, everybody, you should all be making podcasts. You should all be making podcasts. That's what you do. Even if you don't pay attention to my content, make your own content.
I like it.
Yeah. And he went to talking about how the one guest that he wished he could have had on his podcast just so that he could forever have a conversation with this person was his dad. Mm. He started doing podcasts and meant to ask his dad about doing podcasts, and his dad passed doing one with him, and his dad passed away. And so he's like, I wish I could have that conversation, that record. And so here we are together talking about Something Here Will Grow. And in a weird way, this idea of recording, this idea of maintaining experience or whatever, archiving experience, I guess I should say, maybe fits into what I want to talk about with your collection. But first, you know, why don't you introduce yourself to the folks before we drill down into close reading of Something Here Will Grow.
Yeah. So as you said, my name's Jeanette Schaefer, and I'm a freelance writer, nature photographer, part-time singer, and full-time banker. I'm a transplant to the United States from Venezuela. I moved to the United States when I was 3. So I'm part Latin American and part North American. And I was raised in the Detroit and Lansing areas and moved to Pittsburgh about 24 years ago, which is literally half my lifetime ago at this point, because I'm 48. And I have an MFA from Chatham University, and I'm also a playwright and founder of Beautiful Cadaver Project Pittsburgh, which tries to produce socially engaged performance and literary arts. And we have a publishing arm called Social Justice Anthologies, which creates collective works of authors around the world on a variety of socially engaged and important topics.
Fantastic.
And I'm also vice president of one of the largest financial institutions in the United States, but I like to say that that's the least interesting thing about me.
Well, so let's get into a very interesting collection of poems. And for me, there's two things that really I'm left with after reading your poetry in general, and this collection in particular, Something Here Will Grow. One, about the ways in which you engage this interesting line of, I think, the poetics of memory, but also there's a poetics of fiction going on. And also the just profound, as the blurbs say, right, profound sensual imagery. you know, it's hard. It would be hard, I think, to read one of your poems and not have a real sense of place and of moment. If that makes sense.
I think those are probably what I think of as the two most important aspects in literature and poetry that really move me, is its sense of place and its sense of the time in which it lives.
Mm. Yeah, and so this is a dumb question. They're dumb questions, and so I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
But what, you know, I can redeem it by saying this is really a question about process.
Sure.
But how does a poem for you begin? Like, what's that kernel? What's that mustard seed of an idea? And how do you get from that mustard seed of an idea to a draft that you're willing to show other people or put out there for publication?
Oh, sure.
See, I redeemed it. That wasn't a dumb question at all. No,
it's not a dumb question at all.
But I mean, the dumb way of saying it, where do poems come from?
Well, I, in thinking of different artists in a variety of mediums that resonate with me, Frida Kahlo comes to mind, and her subject matter 95% of the time was herself.
Yeah.
And she said part of the reason why she made so many self-portraits was that and I'm totally paraphrasing and probably butchering the quote, but that she was the subject she understood best.
Mm.
And sometimes my writing starts as a way to better understand myself or a way to process something. I think it's also important to note that the narrator of a particular poem is not always the writer of the particular poem.
Yeah.
Not every poem is about me, but I'm in every poem I write. If that makes any sense.
No, that makes sense. And so then my follow-up question about this idea maybe of poetry, of poetics of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's more maybe poetics of memory and poetics of artistic license. And I will say my own baggage as a poet, I'm very hung up on this all happened.
Right.
You know, I have a book coming out soon and literally everything happened except for my best friend, Dave, getting conceived. I mean, that happened, mm-hmm. but I wasn't there for it.
Right.
But I speculate on what Dave's conception would have been like, much to his consternation. But he's been a really good sport about it.
Yeah. But an important mentor to me, Cheryl St. Germain, said, if all we ever write about is ourselves, we will eventually run out of things to write about.
Mm.
And there's like this almost a persona or iconoclastic way that I write in which I'm writing about me, even if I'm really writing about you. So I'm like my own character.
No, that makes sense. And, you know, I had a graduate school professor who once said, as professional as we think we're trying to be, our scholarship is really autobiographical.
Sure.
No matter how many layers we put on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But
now, like, for instance, this is not a poem that appears in this collection, but I had a friend of mine who unfortunately lost a child when the child was 9 years old, complications of a surgery that should have been routine.
Wow.
And I ended up that loss and grief in her life probably spawned 12 or 13 poems of my own in where I was able to tap into some of my own grief on other things much more deeply, because as one of her closest friends, I was, I can't say helping, because I don't know if you can be helped in a situation as tragic as that, but I was holding space with her as she was grieving. And so even though those grief poems were, I guess, technically quote unquote about me, they were really about her.
Interesting. So then that's the question then, to just to clarify for our listeners, then the person of the narrator, is it you going through that particular loss, or you meditating on losses adjacent to that loss? If that makes sense.
I would say meditating on loss as adjacent to that. But then I also wrote a poem about losing a child, even though I've never even had a child. I'm not a mother, so I've never had a child to lose. But in just during that time in my life, sitting so closely with her as she went through that incredibly profound grief, there was no way I could hold that much space with her without it influencing my work. And so then at that point, it became sort of a collective memory.
Ah, I see. And so are the poems in Something Here Will Grow maybe acts of collective memory?
Yeah. So some of them are more of a collective experience, and some of them are a direct experience. For instance, in the poem, The Life He Never Knew, that was a poem that I wrote about my great uncle who passed away in 1927. So obviously I never met this person. That which I know about him is just from listening to stories that my grandmother and my great aunt, Velma, shared with me about him. And so I tried to imagine what the sort of person he would be like had he been able to live past the age of 14. And he was killed during the Bath School disaster, which, if you aren't aware of it, back in 1927, a gentleman who was not elected superintendent and was protesting property taxes for a consolidated school, which means that a bunch of one-room schoolhouses were closed, and all of these one-room schoolhouses were consolidated into one big school, and people would bus their kids in, sort of the modern school system that we know now. He was protesting his property taxes being raised to make this school. So on the last day of school, he had planted, over the course of months, he had planted a bunch of dynamite in the building and detonated it the last day of school. And it was the largest act of domestic terrorism on the United States soil prior to the Oklahoma City bombings.
Wow.
In the 90s. And some 70 some people were killed, most of them children. And my great uncle was one of those children killed in the blast. Wow. And so my memories of him are only from the collective, because obviously this is a person that I never had an opportunity to meet. I only met him through the shared memories of my grandmother and my aunt.
Could you read the poem for us?
Sure.
Can I ask that question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I make that demand, actually? it's not really a question.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is from the perspective of perhaps three different phases of his life. The Life He Never Knew, for Cecil Loren Hunter, 1913 to 1927, killed in the Bath School disaster of 1927. 1927. He was 13 when he died, and his great delight was horses. He had a slow and steady hand with a plow by 12 years old. By the age of 9, he had 4 sisters. Slow to read, he learned his 7th year, and at 4, still sucked his thumb. His gait was sure at 2, strong, gripping fingers, their firstborn, and a son. 1944. He was a soldier now, his uniform reflecting in a sea of foreign blood, his seed spilled inside the legs of a dark-haired girl with eyes too large and melancholy. He retched at the thought of his wife rocking back and forth with worry. He strayed from her this night only, the bourbon too weak to cool the heat of a morning when death erupted from his hands. 1990. He sat at his great niece's graduation, shifting on the wooden bench, squinting at a blur of blue and white students walking towards uncertain futures. The youth made him weep, though he could not remember why, as his papery hand spindled over a last patch of pale hair.
Oh, that's so good.
Thank you.
That's so good. And I think also, you know, one of the things that makes it really good and I mean, this is the thing about this poetics, right? I mean, this character, this uncle, this version of this great uncle, is a complex human being. And so what does it take, or what does it mean to put him in the war in 1944 in that bed? Mm-hmm. Makes him such a rich character.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that I always found particularly tragic about his life and the way his loss impacted my family, I mean, it was bad enough that he died the age he was and in the manner in which he died. But the story that I always heard from my grandmother and my great aunt was he was done with all his exams and had wanted to stay home that day from school. And his mother, my great-grandmother, made him go to school because she's like, it's your last day. Go get your report card. And he never came home.
Wow.
And she never forgave herself for making him go to school that day.
So then the question I have to ask about poetics, I don't know if that might be a hill I'd be willing to die on. Was there a version of that poem with that fact in it?
There was. It's ironic you say that. And I thought that I was scattering my seed too far at that point, because then I was telling her story. I wasn't telling his. And that's probably a poem yet to be written. Mm. Her carrying the weight of what should have been an insignificant decision.
Yeah.
But I haven't written that poem yet. So, but that was something I did try to include, but I ended up it just felt like I was scattering too far. Mm. I wanted to keep the focus on him. And I had also thought about adding different periods in history too. And it just seemed like I wasn't getting him anymore when I tried, because it was originally 2 stanzas longer, with something out of the 60s and something out of the late 70s. And I just was like, I feel like I'm losing who he was in these stanzas. Mm. So I ended up throwing them out.
That makes a lot of sense for me. Again, someone who's a slave to that impulse of, oh, I got to get that really terrible fact in there or something. I guess what you're saying too is, for me, is interesting, is that the idea of that, yes, you are really, you know, the title's not, I'm not making a pun on the title, but like, how do you give this person a life?
Right.
And that's where your responsibility lies for the poem. As opposed to, say, recording experience, or, you know, there is a, I won't say the person's name, but there's a Pittsburgh poet. And I had actually purchased some books of his that he had sold to a local bookshop. And it was fascinating because I got to read this person's annotations. Like, I got these books super cheap because he wrote all over them. And they
See,
were good.
To me, that would make the book more valuable.
Well, it would. I also don't particularly care for this individual's poetry.
Oh, gotcha.
And his maybe mark of literariness is illusion. Mm. And so a lot of his marginalia was, if there were three words together that reminded him of Browning, he would underline them and then draw in pencil to the margin, Browning. And a lot of times some of those were article, adjective, noun sequences. Mm. So yes, that would be the same three words together from a line somewhere else. And I remembered hearing that person read, you know, and this is after Eliot. I'm invoking Eliot here, you know, and that was that person's poetic responsibility. Mm. Was to show that I've read other poems before and that I could use language from other poets. And that was the thing that made it a poem. Because, of course, we know poems don't rhyme anymore.
No.
But something has to make it a poem, right? It's not prose with line breaks. This is the thing, right? When I taught poetry, right? There has to be some element of literariness that is not just prose with extra line breaks.
Oh, sure. And like, to me, rhythm is what makes a poem and not prose with line breaks. Mm. And I don't know if it's from having first been a musician before I was a writer, but when I'm writing a poem, part of the revision process involves me reading the poem aloud several times. Because I find if I trip on a word when I'm reading it out loud, the reader's going to trip on it when they're reading it.
Yeah.
And also, you know, if you look at the origins of poetry, it stemmed from the bards telling stories, and poetry is meant to be read out loud. I think that's another major differential between poetry and prose is to me, poetry begs to be read out loud. Mm. And if it doesn't sound right, when I'm reading it out loud, then it will never look right on the page to me.
That makes a tremendous amount of sense. And so there's not only this question of maybe economy of words to get to meaning, but also economy of words to get to sound and to form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is funny, because the other thing is going on in the back of my head is a personal story that you told me, where you had, I guess it was an email or some sort of comment thread back and forth with someone about writing. And they ask, well, how do you write? And they're like, oh, I just, you know, try to spend an hour every day. And they were like, do you use an app or something? Yeah. Like, what do you use? Oh, okay. And she's like, I just write.
Yeah.
Oh, and the person got very upset at you that, you know, there wasn't something that they could get from the Apple store or the iTunes store or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
He was like,
but like, what are your tricks? And I was like, there's no trick. I make myself carve out some time and then I use that time to write. And they really were quite angry at that answer. You know, like I was going to be able to give them some, they're like, yeah, but you have this full-time job, this, you know, and it's an important full-time job, you know, what, how do you do it? And I'm like, I don't know what you're looking for here, buddy, but I just do it. There's no, I mean, I hate to sound like a curmudgeon, but there's no substitute for working at your craft.
Yeah. Yeah, I think back to, many years ago at an academic conference, I had the opportunity to have dinner with Donald Hall. He was the keynote speaker at the conference. I just happened to get to the dinner early. And one of the professors at IUP kind of called, why don't you sit over here with us? And so I got to sit at the head table just because. And in his keynote address, Donald Hall talked about how for him, that seed of an idea to, I'm ready to send this out, for him, the average was about a year. That he would, and granted, he was at the point where that's what he was. He was a full-time poet. And so his day was getting up at 6, rolling into his office. And he said he kept a meticulous system of files for every version of a poem and would just, from 6 to noon, work on poetry. And then at noon, he would stop, get something to eat, and then take a shower and start his day.
Would that I be so lucky someday.
I know, wouldn't we all? We could be so productive if, you know, it wasn't for this working stuff. But for him, he said, you know, even at that allotment of time, I mean, and he said he did it pretty much at a normal 5-day-a-week work schedule. You know, he, of course, would work on poems concurrently, but for him, a seed of an idea to a draft, and he would never call anything a final draft. In fact, his reader's copies of the books he would send out, or the books that he would read out of at occasions like that, still had annotations on them. He's like, no, the poem's never really finished. But for him, it would be a year from, I have an idea to, that one's done. That one's done enough, I guess.
I have one poem in particular. I'll have to show it to you. Actually, you may have seen it. I think you are one of the poets that I've run it past. I've literally been writing the damn thing for 22 years.
Oof.
At this point. And it's still just not where I want it to be. Mm. And it's even been published and I still don't feel like it's ready. And so I've never publicly read it anywhere, even though it's appeared in print. And
wow.
And I forget who said it, but there's a quote one of my professors used to like to share, and that was, poems are never finished, only abandoned.
Mm.
And every so often I abandon that poem, and then I just like, no, I got to fish it out and try one more time.
Yeah, which begs, you know, this is a metaphor I used to use a lot in the classroom, and I think much to my students' relief, I stopped. But to talk about this kind of work is, you know, you are trying to hit an invisible moving target.
Yes, that's a really good way to put it.
And I think there's something inside that you know when you've hit the target. And you have a general sense where you're aiming, but...
Yeah, and that's the thing too about this target is you don't know what the target is until you've hit it.
This is quite true. And so for you then, I mean, can you articulate? I mean, is there something, you know, yes, I've finally done it.
Is
that something that can be put into like the conscious mind and into words, or is that something just that's so deep within and almost intuitive?
Like when I think about some of my own poems, I think one of the best poems I've written is one called Barn Burning.
Ah.
Where my first draft of it, I was like, there's really something good here. And this is a poem I've been wanting to write for a long time about this sort of this barn that was very symbolic of some of the dysfunction that was present in my early life and in my family growing up. And it seemed like everything that happened was represented by this barn.
Mm.
And like when I wrote, I tried to write other earlier poems about this barn, and none of them was tapping into that kernel that you were talking about. None, you know, where it was like for instance, if I'm writing a poem, it doesn't have to be exactly as the event unfolded necessarily, mm-hmm. but the truth of that event has to be present in every syllable.
That makes sense. A way that I had had this explained to me, or I would say I read an article about Django Unchained.
Mm-hmm.
So some time ago, I did an academic paper presentation about Django Unchained and Inglourious Basterds as these sort of counterfactual histories, right? There really were Jewish resistance fighters in World War II, and there were many slave uprisings during the antebellum South. And the way in which, you know, those films capture movements, ideas, moments, feelings that are as raw as history, but not history.
Mm-hmm.
And one critic, I remember reading this article, and I hopefully printed it out somewhere. I know it's cited, and I should go back and find it, because I think about this a lot. They described, I think at least Django Unchained, about while it might not be factually correct, it is emotionally correct.
Right. I like that. So now in Barn Burning, most of the things that are in the poem happened.
Mm.
Except for one thing, which I don't like to say what the made up thing is, but the made up thing is still a true thing, even if it's not a factual thing.
It's emotionally correct.
Yes.
With that in mind, do you mind reading the poem, and then you listener, I guess, can guess, can speculate. But don't ask. You can't ask. That's vulgar.
Nope. And if you ask, I won't tell you.
So don't even bother.
You're right. So here is Barn Burning. In the red barn, we found magazines with naked children, thick black rectangles of ink blotted out their eyes. In the red barn, we saw the first vagina that did not belong to us. Hair thick, black, and coarse, hands tied above her head, legs splayed, red lace and torn fishnets, flesh bursting through the holes. We ran from the slats between the rotting wood. In the red barn, we found the rat, dead and heavy. First, we poked it with a stick I grabbed the tail, holding on as it turned like a chicken on a spit. I laid it across your palm. It was full of coins that crumbled beneath the dead skin. You took it in the house, showed it to Mother, who beat you as she screamed. In the red barn, our landlord took our neighbor, Libby the Lisper, where he touched her before she went away. We crawled into her empty yard and took apples from the trees, which Mother turned to pies and cobblers, asked if he touched us, you know, down there. In the red barn, I hid with my first lover, a Pakistani boy my dad called a towel head. In the dark, I could only see the whites of his eyes, but I felt him everywhere, my pale legs wrapped around his brown hips, mouth ablaze on my shoulder. I burned down the red barn with a misspent cigarette, another thing hidden, too terrible to confess, except that here and now I am ready, and this is how I tell you.
Not gonna ask. but I will ask, so where, how can people get their hands on, or what's the best way for folks to get their hands on something Here Will Grow? And I will also put links when I post the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. My publisher is Main Street Rag Publishing Company. And you can find the book on their website, which is www.mainstreetrag.com.
All one word.
All one word. www.mainstreetrag.com.
All one word, all standard spelling of all three.
Yes.
Is there another poem you'd like to read? We should move on to the bottom five here in a moment. But is there a poem? Because I chose the first two, and I have a third suggestion. But
oh, okay.
Is there? What do you want to read from? Since you've been so kind to be the test case of recording this podcast on Zoom, as opposed to our typical in-person thing.
I think I want to read "Floating Above Detroit." It's a poem about my early life, and it's one that I'm a little, it's not the best poem I've ever read, but it's a poem I'm very sentimental about because I weave in some Venezuelan folklore in there. And because my biological father abandoned the family, there's so much about Venezuela and our own, your own family mythology that I simply just didn't get an opportunity to learn about. So some of my family stories that I have on my father's side are stories in family mysticism that I've had to make up for myself. And or piece together from relatives that, you know, live either in Venezuela or in Spain, which is, it seems like those are the three countries my family on my father's side settled in, was either Venezuela, Spain, or the United States. And the banker side of me really likes to do research. So it was fun to do some research into some of the Venezuelan tribal mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that's my really long way of saying that I have a sentimental attachment to this poem.
All right. So let us hear it.
Okay. Floating above Detroit. As a child, I haunted the greenhouse, our first home in America, dreaming of flying through space, stars so close my stomach lurched towards heaven, towards Jesus in a bed full of children like me. They said if I believed so hard, he would help me.
I told him my father was missing, asked which star he lived on and if I could fly there. I made sure he knew how sad was my mother, that I missed Abuela's pink basin where she bathed me on hot days, that Detroit had no carnival like Maracay. On the way back to Earth, a Yaruro warrior with red face paint let me wrap my chubby limbs around his tree trunk finger. He told me I had strong tohe, lowered me down a silver cord into the room of my body, into the house where my father once lived.
That is pretty damn good.
Well, thank you.
That's pretty good. And I think does encapsulate, I think, a lot of this theme of a poetics of recording experience, whether it's factually correct or emotionally correct.
Right.
And the use of very rich imagery. So I can see why also that is the first poem in the book. Mm-hmm. All right. You ready to get to the bottom five?
Yes, let's do the bottom five.
Bottom five. All right. And now it's time for the bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Question one. What is the most comforting sound in the world?
A cat purring.
Somehow I knew you'd say that. Question two. Do you experience the pathetic fallacy when looking at objects?
Yes. Particularly at the bank.
You gotta explain that. What do you see at the bank that makes you go, oh?
I would have to say some of the mechanics of banking, like the inside of a ATM machine, it is not nearly so high tech as you would think.
Really?
Yeah. And like the first time I saw a pile, like the very first time I sent out a shipment of money and we were putting together $400,000 to ship out, I thought it was going to be this gigantic pile. And I was like, wow, you really could fit this in a briefcase.
So that thing from movies is
it's one thing from movies that turns out to be totally true.
Really?
A pile of money is really not so big.
Oh wow.
$400,000 really could fit in your duffel bag.
Oh wow. So you say this. Can I divert for a second?
Sure.
Because I've been thinking about the story lately, and I just told the story to somebody I was having a call with. I won't say the name of the band, but it was a very famous, still is a very famous Pittsburgh band. Mm-hmm. And that band was playing a summer festival in the 90s.
Okay.
Going around the country playing, and this was before Squarespace, before Internet Funny Money. And that band would have merch sale days. A bad day was 10 grand. A good day was 30.
Wow.
That just in t-shirts, CDs, stickers, back patches, whatever. Whatever a band could sell in the 90s. Mm-hmm. $10,000 to $30,000 would pass over that table.
Damn.
Yeah. And so there's this story that I had heard secondhand that band, they played Thursday. It was a holiday weekend. So it was either something July 4th, Memorial Day or Labor Day, not sure which. But they played the show, the festival show on Thursday. Friday was an all-day drive, so they didn't get to do the bank drop. The person in charge slept in on Saturday, and they played, Thursday, Friday, went to another city Saturday, played Sunday, played Monday. Tuesday was an off day. And they apparently had showed up at a Wells Fargo somewhere in the Midwest, and they had their normal bag. Granted, this was a lot of small bills.
Sure.
Their normal bag had actually had, it was full. And so they literally walked in with blue plastic Walmart bags, like shopping bags full of cash. And they look like musicians, you know, just showing up. And actually the bank manager's first response was to call the police.
Oh my God.
But before the police got there, they're like, oh, this is our account number. You're going to have to help us count it. And he looked and saw what was in the account and how they had made these large cash deposits in all of these different places. But they said literally, I mean, there was literally like dollar bills fall. They left a trail of money.
Oh my God, that sounds like most tellers I know, that would be their worst nightmare.
Yeah, I guess it was. No wonder they called the cops. But I guess if it was in fives and 20s.
Yeah, my thought is, why would you call the cops on money coming in? Usually you call the cops on money going out.
I guess, well, it is like, where do these people get this money from? This untowardly. But anyway. All right. Question 3. What is your most sublime or awe-inspiring experience with nature?
I've had so many because I'm a really avid hiker. I would say a recent one. This fall, I had hiked in what they call the Cathedral of Trees in Cook Forest. Mm. And it's old growth trees here in Western Pennsylvania. And there's a breed of trees that has, for all intents and purposes, gone extinct. It's an American chestnut tree. And it had fallen prey to a blight in the early part of last century. And they have since bred blight-resistant American chestnut trees, but they are genetically very dissimilar to the original chestnut trees. And in order for these trees to breed, you had to have a male and a female tree. So it required two trees for these trees to breed. And in this old growth forest is what they call a snag of an American chestnut. So it's a dead tree, and it's very tall, and it broke off somewhere in the middle. Mm. And I'd always read about American chestnuts, but obviously I hadn't seen one because they're pretty much extinct. And it seemed like the forestation efforts to control the blight actually made it worse. And they ended up burning forest of chestnut trees to try and contain the blight and ended up obliterating the species. And so I'm looking up at the snag and I put my hand on the bark. And I don't know if the tree was talking to me. I don't get all mystical like that about certain things, but I put my hand on the bark and I felt like my hand was buzzing. And so I put my other hand on the bark and I just felt this complete overwhelming sadness. And I ended up wrapping my arms around the tree and just like sobbing for 5 minutes.
Wow.
Because I just felt like just the utter loneliness and desolation of being a dead tree and one of the last of your species.
Wow. That's wild. All right, question 4. Nothing.
Yeah, that went dark.
That went really dark. But I totally get it. I totally get it. I think as a poet, being open to those sorts of experience, that like something, this is something that happened to me and this means something more than just I saw a dead tree.
Right.
And being able to suss out that meaning.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm not usually somebody who goes, the tree talked to me. Like, that fucking tree talked to me.
Solid. Question 4, what's your least favorite city?
Least favorite city. I guarantee it's in Ohio.
Yeah, that's a solid choice. That's a strong hand to pick a card from is Ohio.
I hate to say it because the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is there and I'm a big classic rock fan, but one of the few times I've ever felt an actual danger. So I'm actually going to pick two cities. I'm going to break the rules. Cleveland, Ohio, and Lansing, Michigan.
Okay.
And both, the reason I dislike both of those cities is in both of those cities, something that should have been routine ended up almost dangerous. And it was because some of my own naivete and also just the fact that bad people do bad things.
Wow.
So I have it's not because of the cities themselves, but because of a particular memory that has imprinted on me because it happened in that city.
Oh, wow. All right. Both Rust Belt cities too. Both not far. Yeah. You can see both in a day.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, and I'm a Rust Belt girl, man. Cause I grew up in Michigan.
You went from Detroit to Pittsburgh.
Well, Detroit to the Lansing area and then circuitous route to Niles, Michigan, and then to Pittsburgh. Yeah. So.
All right. Question 5. We're almost through this.
All right.
Tell me about a turning point in history that most folks don't seem to remember or recognize as important.
I'm going to say the assassination of John Lennon. Now, it was important because he was a public figure and a Beatle, and the Beatles are much beloved. But I would say that's when the counterculture lost their innocence.
Mm.
And we saw not only the power of words, but the danger of them.
Mm.
And so to me, the right kind of poetry strikes that balance between the truth and the right kind of danger.
Interesting. All right, on that note, I think that's about it. Again, Something Here Will Grow is available through Main Street Rag Publishing Company. There'll be links in the podcast, even embedded in the MP3. Our next episode will eventually happen, probably in fewer than 7 months. And it'll be about something. Our homepage where you can find new and old episodes is gonnadiepodcast.com. Or also, hopefully, if the RSS feeds haven't gone bad, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, or it's now just Google Podcasts. Stitcher, it's been so long that one of the podcast platforms has gone away forever. Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and hopefully Mixcloud as well, if I remind myself to upload it. That's the only one that doesn't upload automatically. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Maybe we'll be on Instagram someday. Who knows? Thanks to our guest, Jeanette Schaefer. Later, meets.